I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
I think we're moving into stage four EU. This is kind of how I started to conceive of things. So if stage one is kind of coal and steel, it's the coal and steel community, it's about France and Germany, it's about make sure we don't repeat the horrors of the 20th century. Stage two, I think, is a story about the single market in the kind of the late 80s and the 90s. Stage three is Eurozone and expansion. And I think stage four is an EU defined in opposition to Russia. So I think we are already seeing the shoots of this in light of what's been happening in Ukraine. You can see the EU taking some pretty big political decisions about its future in response to that.
Hello and welcome to Behind the Lines. I'm Arthur Snell. In this podcast, one of the issues I've wanted to cover is Britain's relationship with the EU, how it is now and how it might be in the future. It feels like the most important question in British politics, and yet it's one that political parties don't want to touch. For that reason, it was a great pleasure to speak to Sidney Nash, who's been a civil servant working on European affairs and also an advisor to industry on the EU and Brexit. We had an extended conversation which is going to go out as two episodes. The first of these is about the EU now, its institutional strength and where it's going in the immediate future. The second episode is all about how Britain could change that relationship with the EU. And that will go out later this week.
My name's Sidney Nash. I'm a former UK civil servant. So I spent about 10 years working in the UK civil service. I did a range of things before really focusing on EU policy and EU strategy. So I led the work on the UK single market policy under the coalition government before then moving towards strategic engagement with the EU, all the institutions, and indeed the member states as well. I then led the UK automotive sector's work on Brexit and international trade from late 2016 up until 2020. My leaving the UK government in 2016 was nothing to do with Brexit. It happened before the referendum, but a referendum then did fundamentally change the job I was going to do for automotive, which was meant to be new technologies, connecting autonomous vehicles, but it became Brexit and international trade because it was an all-consuming issue for that sector.
Yeah, well, fascinating. You've really been at the front line of the Brexit story. But actually, because you mentioned single market, the pre-Brexit sort of era, coalition era, if you're happy for me to do that, I'd like to start there, actually, because, of course, the UK was very much a big advocate of proponent of the single market and was trying to increase its range. It very much didn't feel that it had sort of reached its apogee. Can you say a bit about that and the sort of ambitions? Because it's a reminder of how quickly things changed, the ambitions that Britain had in that sort of 2010 to 2015 period in relation to the single market.
Yeah, and it's perhaps a story about how things have changed in the Conservative Party, because it feels like it's a different type of Conservative Party that was promoting single market policies at that time. And you're absolutely right; they were seeking to really focus around services. So to sense correctly that the single market in services wasn't complete, and there was much more that could be done there to increase that kind of depth of cohesion in the single market in services. Clearly beneficial to the UK economy, big services economy, but not only to the UK economy. Works for other parts of the EU as well, and also looking towards new technology. So when we're working on that single market policy, one strand of that was around the digital single market. So what does a single market look like in a connected online age, and how do we kind of exploit the opportunities in that space? So that was really kind of core to that policy. It was very much in the context of 2008, the post-financial crash, and the need to boost growth again. And in fact, one thing that we produced alongside that was a short leaflet called Let's Choose Growth. And I'm sure people dig around to the depths of the internet, it could be found somewhere. Something that Michel Barnier was particularly keen on, a document that he referred to at points during the Brexit negotiations, although you'd have to be quite attuned to recognize that's what he was talking about. But yeah, really focused on the single market, really focused on, I guess, that core UK legacy around kind of EU integration on that economic side.
And what's interesting is that obviously it wasn't at the top of the political agenda. It's a fairly sort of technocratic issue. But I do remember that in that period, it was very clearly stated by politicians of probably most parties, but certainly the governing Tory and Lib Dem parties, that this would lead very directly to an increase in Britain's GDP, to sort of economic growth for Britain. And then, we were perhaps, two and a bit years from the government policy being that we wouldn't even be a member of that single market, let alone try and make it bigger and better and more functional.
Absolutely. I mean, the contrast is incredibly stark on those two things. I think there was cross-party consensus. New Labour under Blair, under Brown, were pro-single market. Obviously, this all starts with the story around Margaret Thatcher and the Conservative Party in the late 80s and through the 1990s. And it was very much consistent with the Liberal Democrats' pro-EU stance. And I think they saw it as a way to kind of bolster the positive narrative around the EU and stave off some of that kind of anti-EU sentiment that, of course, had been growing for some time. So, yeah, it's quite striking. The change was prompted by a decision made by the public, of course, but how that decision was then implemented was notably inconsistent with that. Not just a hard Brexit, leaving the single market, but also really not prioritising services in negotiations around the Trade and Cooperation Agreement. And it's almost like that prior history of the UK and the EU, that economic analysis, that understanding of where our advantages are as a country, were simply forgotten.
Again, a fascinating point, because even now, when we talk about the challenges that Britain faces outside the EU, we still tend not to talk as much about services as we do about things like agricultural produce. Whereas, Britain, yes, of course, agriculture is an important sector in our economy, but it's never been a particularly significant sector. And we are a services economy. The one thing we might realistically claim to be world beating at is services.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. Obviously, I was working for a manufacturing sector during the kind of the heat of the Brexit negotiations, but actually, it was a services sector as well. And this is one of the conversations that we're having in government in that period, 2010 to 2015, which is actually, services and goods are wrapped together. If you're an automotive and you're building your factory and you've got some fancy robotics that have been made by Bosch, you've got a services package around those robotics. Or if you're selling the vehicle to a consumer, you're selling with a service package wrapped around it. So these two things weren't separated. But I think conceptually, I think for the media, and I think for many politicians, it's easier to talk about physical goods and to kind of think about those crossing borders and what that does mean if there are barriers. Much harder to talk about services and things that feel a little bit less tangible. And then politically, a lot harder to talk about services because that actually means people as well. And that's one of the challenges.
Well, we've sort of gone right into a fairly technical issue, but let's take a little step back. when we've met once before, and we had a fascinating discussion about a whole range of things, but I was really struck by your perception of sort of where the EU is in its own story. And of course, again, the Brexit has been such a kind of inward looking process that it's always been about how Britain interacts with this institution that we sort of see as fixed. And of course, that it isn't that. It's evolving most significantly, perhaps, in the light of the Ukraine conflict. But there are a lot of other factors resting on it as well. So could you say a bit about how you see where the EU is now and where it might be going over the next decade? Because, of course, that's, in a way, the period in which our own relationship with it may or may not change.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, always hard to predict the future. I'm more comfortable talking about the past, yeah, having studied history. But I think we're moving into stage four EU. This is kind of how I started to conceive of things. So if stage one is kind of coal and steel, it's the coal, yeah, and steel community. It's about France and Germany. It's about make sure we don't repeat the horrors of the 20th century. Stage two, I think, is a story about the single market in the kind of the late 80s and the 90s. Stage three is Eurozone and expansion. And I think stage four is an EU defined in opposition to Russia. So I think we are already seeing the shoots of this in light of what's been happening in Ukraine. And it is, you can see the EU taking some pretty big political decisions about its future in response to that, not least around Ukraine's potential pathway into the EU, but not just Ukraine, Moldova as well, discussions around Georgia, potential impacts around how the EU conceives of itself militarily. The politics around that are tricky, but the money is telling a story, how the EU is looking to spend money because of that conflict is telling a story. The impacts on energy supply, et cetera, et cetera. It feels to me that this is the new defining issue. I think what's interesting compared to stages one to three is this is a reactive, at this moment in time, it feels like it's a reactive reshaping of the EU rather than a proactive reshaping of the EU. Quite where that will end up, I don't know. It's an unpredictable moment in time, but it feels like that is the thing that's defining this next stage of the EU. And that then has consequences, of course, for the UK and its relationship with it.
Yeah. And of course, there are elements of that. It forces the EU into very new and unfamiliar areas. I mean, that some of these areas are familiar, are well established. The question of whether or not new members can join Ukraine, Georgia, others on the sort of on Russia's frontier. Those are, in a way, not new questions. They're versions of old questions, but there are big new questions. Can the EU get involved in supplying weapons? Well, I mean, that question has been answered, but it was not an easy one to answer initially. Is the EU an actor on a kind of strategic military intelligence level that is perhaps still unanswered? Where do you think those things are trending?
I think that's a really good question. It might be easier to answer it after the elections in June.
Just for listeners' benefit, we're talking about the EU parliamentary
elections. The EU parliamentary elections, and then what, of course, that means for a new commission going forward. I think at this moment in time, it's trending in a direction where I think there's a clearer recognition of the regional geostrategic threats facing the EU as a collective than perhaps there was, say back in my days in government. And I do remember we did a lot of work with colleagues in the Baltics, with the Czechs and the Poles. And on occasion we'd talk about issues about Russia. And it was striking how different their perception was, the perception I felt there was in the UK government. It's not that I was working in foreign policy per se, so I wasn't deep in those conversations. But their concerns were much starker than I think they were in London. They were, I think, a lot more realistic about what they were hearing coming out of Moscow at that time. I think they'd been shown to be kind of correct. So what does that kind of mean going forward? Well, I think Brussels sees the world like colleagues in Vilnius and Prague and Warsaw were seeing the world. I think that they have caught up. I think that will have implications in terms of budgets going forward, depending on what happens vis-a-vis the war in Ukraine, what happens vis-a-vis decisions in Washington, and that recognition that this is not a war that Ukraine can be allowed to lose. So I think the point I was making was that I think the EU clearly understands now the threat posed by Russia and the fact that that Ukraine cannot lose that war, because it presents a series of existential consequences for the EU, but also just for Europe as a whole. It's not just an EU issue. It is a Europe issue and a Europe security issue.
Yeah.
And that has to play into decision-making going forward. I can't see how that doesn't. What that then means in terms of where the money goes, in terms of, can the EU be a supplier of weapons? Or what does that mean? Maybe not as explicitly as a supplier of weapons, but for EU industrial policy, for example. What does that mean for some of the joint funding that the Germans and the French sometimes do on some of these big issues? Where will those decisions go? And then what does it mean about the relationships between the member states as well? So, we could have a long conversation about Hungary. I'm not a Hungary expert, but Viktor Orban's not alone as being a EU leader sitting around the council table who is perhaps a bit more sympathetic to Moscow than some others are. Perhaps you can kind of get away with that during a time of peace, but we're not in a time of peace anymore, in a time of war. So what does that mean to that relationship amongst the member states about the willingness, the ability to make sure everybody's on the same page, to discipline other member states, if that is a reasonable way of putting it? I think all that stuff just has to kind of play out in real time. It's such a multifaceted dynamic, the politics in the EU, 27 member states with all your commissioners, with all your MEPs. The MEPs aren't necessarily from the same parties as the governing party that sits around the council table. There's so many different voices involved. It's quite hard to pick out how that plays out. But I get a sense there's a Brussels consensus that's developed, and that may pull things in a particular direction going forward.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Yeah. So there are many aspects of this, and I suppose that one of the huge ones is where America's going. So over a long term, over decades, America is clearly tilting gradually to a kind of focus on the Pacific, the rise of China and so on. But America keeps being dragged back to Europe, whether willingly or unwillingly. But what we do know is, I think it's pretty unarguable, is that in a second Trump presidency, America will minimize its commitments in Europe. It may want to, basically give Ukraine to Russia. It may want to withdraw from NATO. That's a sort of worst case scenario. Or it may just draw back its support levels, that it almost the same effect takes place, even though sort of it's not a stated policy. But that's something that could be happening, later this year, or certainly the very start of next year. So what do you think the EU, rather than Europe, but the EU is thinking and doing about that?
Well, looking at it from the outside, it doesn't feel like they're doing a lot. And I hope I'm wrong about that, because I think the scenarios you set out vis-a-vis a Trump presidency are the right ones. There's a real risk that Europe's security blanket is taken away from it by this time next year. And it doesn't really require the US to leave NATO. It just requires them to kind of undermine Article 5, just with the comments they make and the kind of the background noise that they make. I fear what kind of encouragement that might give to Moscow, if that were to be the case. There's a huge amount that the EU would have to do to backfill that, or Europe collectively. I'm mixing up my terms here. Europe would have to do to backfill that, because it's not just, again, it's not just an EU issue. And it doesn't feel to me, looking from the outside in, that there's a huge amount happening. Now, I think if we were having this conversation just before Russia invaded the Ukraine, I might say that looking from the outside in, it doesn't feel like there's a huge amount happening in Brussels to prepare for that possibility. But to their credit, I think there was quite a lot that was taking place, and there were a lot of conversations that were taking place. There may, one can make the case there should be more preparation, et cetera, et cetera. But there were things happening behind the scenes. Yeah. These, of course, are very sensitive conversations, and I wouldn't necessarily expect them to be all over the front page of the newspapers anyway. So, I do hope those conversations are taking place. I think even if there isn't a Trump presidency, though, it's a discussion that has to happen anyway.
Of course.
The world, like you say, is changing. It wasn't Trump that initially said, let's pivot to Asia. It was Obama, right? It was a Democratic president.
Yeah.
Biden.
And it was Obama's presidency that started saying quite aggressive things about EU spending in defense. Well, not EU members and NATO members, which again is, is a reasonable thing. But it's sometimes those words, you write them down and you could say to people, did Trump say this or did Obama say it? And people aren't sure.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's often forgotten, right, that, Trump's bellicose words around NATO were not all that inconsistent with what you see on the other side of the aisle in Washington. And arguably not all that unreasonable in terms of the kind of points that are being made. So, I think obviously we are closely linked with the US in terms of security and politics as a country, UK, as a continent, Europe, living in kind of a post-45 world. I don't think any European who looked at it seriously would say we want to just go it alone. We don't care if America's involved in the European continents or not. I mean, there may be some, but I think that would be pretty cavalier to take that approach. Mm. So I think the question you need to ask is, well, if there has always been a kind of latent isolationism in the United States that we kind of slightly forgot about post-45, but is perhaps re-emerging somewhat, most vocally and explicitly under Trump, but maybe there are elements of it on both sides of the aisle. And even if it isn't about isolationism, it's just about refocusing your foreign policy attention to another part of the world. What does that then mean for us, frankly, collectively as Europe, taking responsibility for our neighborhood security? And how do we work together to do that?
Yeah.
And I think then that does kind of lead into the question, okay, so then what is the UK relationship with the EU post-Brexit in that context?
Yeah, so you landed just where I wanted to go. We've got to the UK, and I think there's obviously a lot of elements to where the UK's relationship with the EU is going. We could start with the TCA, the basis on which we eventually left, which is obviously probably far different to most people's expectations. And there's then also the prospect of a non-conservative government. At some point this year, looking very likely now with all the polling pointing in that direction. But equally, actually, Labour are saying publicly, at least, that Brexit is a done issue, that it's not there to be reopened. So there's a sort of geopolitical, geostrategic question about the UK's relationship. And then there are kind of technocratic questions about improving the sort of workability. And then, of course, there's a long-term question about whether or not we might aspire to rejoin the organisation. So perhaps if we could start with that first one, which is where you sort of landed, that geostrategic question. We still don't have any kind of formal basis of interacting with the EU on kind of global security and geopolitical issues, do we?
No, we don't. So, our conversation...
Which it just seems amazing, isn't it? There's a massive war raging in Europe, and there's another one right on the boundary of Europe. I'm talking about Gaza. And we don't we have we right now we don't have a means of interacting with the EU on those issues.
And there's a clear and evident kind of gap. And maybe the second half of this year, post two elections, so European Parliament and then getting a new commission and then and a UK election as well, will be the right moment to kind of have that conversation about let's have some type of agreed institutional structure around kind of a security conversation. So it's slightly complicated, of course, by the fact that you're having that partly in NATO, of which many EU members are members of, but not all.
Yeah.
Then there's a conversation happening within the EU, which of course doesn't include us anymore. And I guess it's like, how do you square all this? So you make sure you have your kind of biggest military partners and security partners in Europe all at the table thinking collectively about this stuff. So I think there is a job to be done to work that out. I think it has to be a structure that is, well, I was going to say, I think it has to be a structure that needs to be kind of separate from kind of EU structures for reasons of kind of political sensitivity in the UK, but maybe that's not really the case. But it needs to be something that's kind of fleet of foot. I mean, the risk is we kind of, one over designs a way of doing this.
Yeah.
Whereas actually, in some ways, it's like, we'll have an annual or biannual conversation of EU plus member states and the UK and Turkey, or whatever it is, right, that brings the right people around the table, necessarily at this stage, but certainly information exchanging, coordinating, and thinking collectively about Europe's security.
Yeah. And of course, there are, even within the post-Brexit era, there are precedents, aren't there? There was the occasion, I think, Liz Truss, one of her brief achievements as Prime Minister was to go to Brussels and attend both an EU summit, presumably on some kind of observer basis, and then a NATO summit, whilst not admitting that she'd been to the EU one in any of the sort of pieces to camera and other kind of interviews that she did. But there have been moments when British prime ministers have showed up in Brussels since Brexit. There's no reason why we couldn't do that again.
No, exactly. And there's that kind of nascent leaders conference that's happened, I think, a couple of times now. And nothing's fixed in stone. Things need to evolve. There's been endless conversations within the EU for as long as I can remember about kind of multi-speed or concentric circles around the EU, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And I feel that those will continue, and maybe they'll get some momentum behind them because of the situation on the security side. And, at the risk of sounding like I think the UK is the most important place in the world and, British exceptions and all the rest of it. But I think in that context, wise heads would want the UK to be part of that conversation.
So then let's talk a bit about the more sort of technocratic stuff. And I mean specifically here, the TCA, the our current basically trade deal with the EU. There's lots of evidence it's very dysfunctional. It doesn't sort of deliver frictionless trade as it was advertised to do, which in a way is not surprising because it was said to be frictionless trade but was designed to create friction. Where should we start with that? What are the things if you're a new Labour government? They need to demonstrate that they're offering benefits to Britain's trading terms of trade. Where would we start? What might be the things that could happen quite quickly that don't look like us joining the customs union, for example?
I mean, on the deal itself, I understand why you say it's dysfunctional. I think it's actually functioning exactly how the designers of it wanted it to, which is a very hard Brexit. I mean, that's the corner that they painted themselves into. And it goes to what you were saying right at the beginning about what happened to being pro-single market, what happened to that kind of Thatcherite vision for how the EU's economy might well work, and how trade in the EU might well work.
What you're saying is it delivers sort of David Frost's vision of how we should interact with
Europe. I think it delivers where the Brexiteers in Parliament ultimately landed. I mean, they went on a journey on this from being pro-single market and pro-customs union to getting ever harder in their position that period kind of 2016 through to, you know, the end of 2020. And they pretty much got what they wanted, because some of them still wanted no deal. So for some of them, this still isn't hard enough. But nevertheless, I think, you know, the fact that there's a lot of friction and a lot of additional costs is, you know, the inevitable kind of consequence of where they landed politically. So what does that then mean for a new government, assuming that's a Labour government?
Well, listeners, I hope you're interested in Sydney's answer to that question. What does it mean for a new government, particularly assuming that we will see probably a change of government, a Labour government, at some point this year? To hear his answer, you're going to have to listen to the next episode of this podcast, which, as I said at the outset, is going to come out later this week. Thanks for listening to this episode of Behind the Lines, produced and presented by me, Arthur Snell. The theme music was by Matty Bedford.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.